You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Before we start the show, I want to ask for your help. If you enjoy Kick-Ass Politics, I hope you'll help us reach our goal of raising our full production budget for 2016 by donating on our website at kickasspolitics.com or at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the show. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. My guest today is Australian journalist Michael Ware. He's a former Baghdad bureau chief for Time magazine and war correspondent for CNN. In 2003, Michael Ware arrived in Baghdad as a novice reporter on a three-week assignment to cover the invasion of Iraq. He left 7 years later, having gained unprecedented access to the Iraqi insurgency and American troops, and scarred by having seen the unimaginable brutality of the group that eventually became ISIS. Now, his story is told in a new documentary called Only the Dead See the End of the War. The film is a collaboration between Michael Ware and two-time Oscar-winning director Bill Guttentag, and it airs tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Today, Michael Ware will talk about the time he was kidnapped and nearly beheaded by the group that was known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, now called ISIS, and he'll reveal how he became, in his words, obsessed with the leader of that group, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Plus, he'll talk about being embedded with the U.S. Marines during the grueling Battle of Fallujah and having a front-row seat for the birth of the modern-day terrorist nation-state called ISIS. That and more coming up with war correspondent Michael Ware in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Today I'm joined in the studio by Michael Ware. He was a war correspondent for Time magazine and CNN, covering the war in Iraq from the moment the coalition forces invaded all the way through the surge. His experience is the subject of a new feature-length documentary that airs on HBO tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, called Only the Dead See the End of the War. Michael, thanks for joining me.
G'day, mate. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, the film is a collaboration between yourself and two-time Oscar-winning director Bill Guttentag. It uses mostly your own handycam footage from when you were covering the war in Iraq. And I'll warn people, it's not exactly a fun, lighthearted romp for the whole family here.
No, it's pretty graphic. I would suggest that this is the most intense and confronting war film that may have ever been made, because, you know, it's not a Hollywood version, and there's been incredibly noble efforts by Hollywood, but, you know, there the blood is corn syrup.
Yeah.
Here, this is real. This is what your Marines and your soldiers went through. This is what the Iraqis went through. The blood and the death that you will witness in this film is real. And this isn't a film that you're going to watch as a viewer. This is a film that you're going to experience.
Yeah.
Because
it's very visceral.
Because when it's a Hollywood film, you know it's actors. As intense as it may be. And with most documentaries, there always seems to be some kind of a distance between you, the viewer, and the events on a screen. Well, in this film, we believe that we transport you into war. Because war is something not that you watch or go through. War is something that you feel.
Yeah.
And you give us tonight 78 minutes of your life, and I guarantee you, you'll not be the same person at the end of that 78 minutes because you will have felt what war is like.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say you won't be the same person at the end of the film, because that's a lot of this film reminded me of, I don't know if you've ever read Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness.
Are you kidding? That was the genesis of our story.
Yeah, yeah, and you arrive in Iraq full of pep, and this is all part of the atmosphere. Everyone thought this was going to be over in 2 weeks, and then very quickly you did start to descend toward a very dark place in this film. What did you think this war was going to be when you first took this assignment and landed on the ground in Iraq?
Well, this wasn't my first war. I mean, I did Afghanistan for 18 months beforehand. Prior to that, I'd been covering small conflicts throughout Southeast Asia.
Right.
The coup d'etat in the Solomon Islands, the fight for independence in East Timor, the tribal highland wars in Papua New Guinea. But I knew nothing about Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew nothing. I bought one book before the invasion and read it as quickly as I could to learn about Saddam and the broad history of modern history of the country. Going into the Iraq war, I knew it would be, a few things. I knew it would be hot and I knew it would be cold. I knew I'd be hungry and I would be tired. I knew it would be bloody and I knew it was going to hurt. Now, the politics of the Iraq war were completely divorced from me.
Yeah.
And that was an extraordinary blessing that contributed magnificently, I believe, to my reporting, because all the Beltway nonsense in DC, I mean, I'd been living in Kandahar, Afghanistan for the last year. I didn't have a clue what was being said on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. The debate about WMD and whether they existed or whether they didn't, I'd never set foot on Iraqi sand. How was I to know if there was WMD or not? I knew what the UN said. I remember in February 2003 what Colin Powell was telling the Security Council. But like most of the general public, that was about it. My job was to go and cover the conflict, however it unfolded. And for me, that's in a political vacuum.
Yeah.
No war is in a political vacuum. As von Clausewitz tells us, the great German military strategist, all war is policy by another means.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I mean, I was my role was to go and tell the story on the ground,
mm-hmm.
be that, say, during the invasion of the Green Berets I bumped into, be that of the Peshmerga, be that of the Iraqi civilians. That was my job. My expectations of the war, thankfully, were none.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because I'm curious, how long did it take after, quote unquote, mission accomplished, before you started to realize that there was something very different that was going on the ground in Iraq?
One big difference was this is the first time I'd seen us as the West in occupation.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I found that an emotionally challenging thing. Now, we were doing it for all the right reasons, to liberate this country, to free it from, the constrictions of a dictatorship, but we were occupying. Beyond that, and what quickly overtook that at, light speed,
mm-hmm.
was the arrival of holy war.
Yeah.
We never saw it coming. I don't think the Iraqis saw it coming.
Right.
But once the holy war began in that first summer of 2003, once what today we call the Islamic State arrived, we were in an entirely different war. And we were in a war that I knew from that first moment was going to be generational.
Yeah, and it's amazing because it's really, you know, the film gives us a window into the birth of ISIS.
Very much.
We witnessed the inception of ISIS.
We witnessed its birth.
And one of the things that distinguishes you as a journalist is that you got to see both sides of the story, and you reported on the insurgency from the point of view of the insurgents as well as the coalition forces. And I'm very curious, how did you first make contact with the insurgents?
Well, you know, I arrived in Iraq well before the invasion. I was in the north in Kurdistan with the Kurdish Peshmerga forces fighting against Saddam, who were then subsequently joined by Green Berets. So that's how I did the invasion, from the war, from the north, from the forgotten war. But then once the invasion was over, and let's not forget, first there's the invasion. 21 days of stunningly successful maneuver warfare that brought down an entire regime.
Yeah.
That was not the Iraq War.
Yeah.
The Iraq War began the next day after the invasion. So when I arrived in Baghdad, that's when the war was really beginning. And at first it was ad hoc, angry Iraqis almost randomly picking up AK-47s and taking pot shots at passing American convoys. Now, it was during that summer that I would listen to the American war machine and the American commanders and to the kids on the ground talking about, you know, who was shooting at them. And they honestly and genuinely had no idea who these men were. Or why on earth would they be shooting at us? We're trying to bring democracy, right?
Yeah, we're the liberators.
In inverted commas.
Yeah. Huh.
And when it dawned on me that the war machine really didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, one of the fundamental principles of journalism, one of the basic canon, is that there's at least two sides to every story.
Mm-hmm.
So for whatever reason, I took it upon myself to go and find these men who are pulling these triggers and to ask them simply, who are you and why are you doing this?
Yeah.
Now, the way I did that was through whatever story it was I was pursuing that day or that week. At the end of every interview with an Iraqi, I would ask them about the insurgency. You know, it almost yet wasn't an insurgency. And I would ask if you'd been in the army. And yes, I had. And I'm not one of the guys pulling a trigger right now. But you know what? I like you. I trust you. You might want to go and talk to the mate of mine from my old unit. You might want to go and see what he has to think. And from him, I would meet another. And from that one, another. And on and on. It was a cascade of personal trust.
Okay. So you pursued these people. They didn't show up at your doorstep.
Oh, are you joking? No, they were. I found the people that the American military was hunting.
Yeah.
These were not people waiting to be found. I had to pursue them.
Yeah. And were these initial insurgents, were they Saddam loyalists? Were they former, you know, Republican Army members?
No, they were American revolutionaries. You think about the Brits and King George and.
Yeah. That's a bold statement.
It's a fact, man. I mean, now, whether we were there with you know, good intent and we're trying to do all the right things.
Yeah.
As these people would say to me, if there's a foreign tank sitting on your child's street corner, what would you do about that?
Mm-hmm.
If we as Americans or Australians had to ask a Chinese soldier for permission to go to the market, how would you feel about that? That's what these guys were doing. I mean, these were Iraq's version of West Pointers.
Right.
Many of whom had been American allies for decades.
Yeah.
I remember meeting someone who went on to become a member of the Iraqi National Insurgent High Command.
Mm-hmm.
And this is still in the summer of 2003. And he's sitting back with his grandchildren in his house in the village on the river. And he said to me, Michael, in the 70s, I did Pathfinder and Ranger training in the United States. in the 80s, I used American satellite imagery to slaughter Iranians. Under Saddam, we liked to drink, we liked to chase prostitutes. We didn't let Al-Qaeda in here. Every time Saddam purged his military, who do you think he was killing? So when you took out Saddam, we have absolutely no problem with that. So, Michael, can you now explain to me in the summer of 03 under the occupation how all of a sudden, after decades of cooperation, we're suddenly on the opposite sides of this thing?
Your initial communications are with insurgents who
it's with these people.
Yeah, those people, not Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And you say, you know, when the suicide bombings began, that's when you started to become curious about this mysterious, gruesome group and the person behind it, who was Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. When did he first come on your radar?
Well, we first heard about Zarqawi during the invasion. Because, okay, I don't want to bore your listeners, but a quick footnote of history that everyone's forgotten. When people think back to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, in their minds are long columns of American armor charging through the desert north to Baghdad. Well, you know that there was another invasion, right? That was the invasion of the north. In the original war plan, the 4th Infantry Division was to come in through Turkey and tanks were going to blast down from the north south towards Baghdad. Well, at the last minute, the Turks prevented permission for those troops to pass through. So the invasion of the war from the north was a rerun of Afghanistan. It was a war fought in high mountain terrain in snow. Part of my invasion was fought in snow.
Wow.
With Green Berets fighting with local Kurdish Peshmerga forces, the same forces now fighting the Islamic State. And in the north, there was two wars. One was the war against Saddam's people, but in a tiny pocket of Kurdistan, tucked up against the Iranian border, was the future of the Iraq war. Because there was an Islamic group called Ansar al-Islam. They controlled 17 villages. And one of Colin Powell's remarks to the Security Council was that this is an Al-Qaeda-aligned group that was attempting to dabble with WMD, which we largely believe to be true. But after the invasion of Afghanistan, people like Zarqawi fled our invading forces when we brought down the Taliban, passed through Iran and stopped in Kurdish Iraq with Ansar al-Islam. So I witnessed the first ever suicide bombing of the Iraq war. It was before the invasion, February 26, 2003. What I saw on that tiny front line with those Green Berets and those Kurds fighting these Islamists told me more about the war that was to come and that we still live with than anything that had anything to do with Saddam Hussein. So the insurgency was local good old boys, ex-West Pointers, who were fighting to free their country. And anyone could relate to that. They were fighting for a seat at the political table of power. What was separate was the arrival of the Holy War.
Yeah.
And that was done by the Jordanian militant Zarqawi, the man who created the Islamic State. And it only took him a year or two before he hijacked the entire war. And unwittingly, inadvertently, it was our invasion of Iraq that unleashed the Islamic State upon the world. No one could have seen it coming. And we're still, to this day, trying to put that genie back in that bottle.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with filmmaker and war correspondent Michael Ware. Back in just a moment. Hey, folks. Do you like reading but you don't have the time? Then maybe it's time to start listening to audiobooks. Audiobooks are the perfect thing to listen to on your drive to work or on the treadmill at the gym, or how about while you're cooking dinner or relaxing in the tub? You don't have to carve out an hour or two of your day just to focus all your attention on reading a book anymore, because audiobooks are great just about anywhere. And right now, you can listen to an audiobook for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics, or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. We're back, and I'm talking with filmmaker and former war correspondent for Time Magazine and CNN, Michael Ware. So, Michael, tell me this. You have a lot of contact with the insurgents in the earlier part of the film and in the early part of the war, and the non-Al-Qaeda insurgents who, it seems, kind of have a rivalry with Al-Qaeda.
Well, it's not Al-Qaeda. Forget Al-Qaeda.
Right. Well, Al-Qaeda
was terrified.
Zarqawi. Yeah.
No.
Which is
Zarqawi called himself Al-Qaeda in Iraq for about 12 months. And that was purely just branding.
Yeah. Huh.
Al-Qaeda was terrified of Zarqawi. Like we see to this day in Syria,
mm-hmm.
Al-Qaeda's affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra, is at war as much with the Islamic State as they are with Assad.
Yeah.
Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have never been fellow travelers. Mm-hmm. There was one period for about a year and a half where Zarqawi agreed to brand himself as Al-Qaeda, but it was very temporal, and it didn't last long.
Yeah. He hijacked it, basically.
And they had to reject him.
He was even too violent for Osama bin Laden.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So for us now, in hindsight, to talk about Al-Qaeda in Iraq, there's one period where that was technically correct.
Yeah.
But in essence, it never, ever was. From day one, it was the Islamic State.
Yeah. And you talk about, you say that you became obsessed, to use your words, with al-Zarqawi. What was it about him that you were obsessed about, that you wanted to know about this guy?
Well, I'd never seen a human darkness like that.
Mm.
Like all of us, you know, students of history, students of politics, you know, I'd read about these people and these dark forces of history. I've seen films about them. I've, you know, watched documentaries about them. Can you imagine actually being there when one of these dark forces is born, these dark forces of history? More than that, to be able to reach out and touch them, and worse, to have them touch you back. I mean, I went to one of the first ever Islamic State training camps.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting parts of the movie.
And when Zarqawi created his first ever propaganda masterpiece, something now that we're inundated through the Islamic State's social media. But back then, this was pre-YouTube, pre-Twitter, pre-Facebook. When he created that first ever video masterpiece, he gave that to me.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
As a student of history, as a student of humanity, as a human being, when something like that reaches out and touches you, that's going to change you.
Yeah.
And I became obsessed. Not just because these people came to dominate and hijack the war. They changed modern political history.
Yeah.
They changed modern military history. But they changed modern human history. And my God, my goodness, I was compelled by that. I'd never seen anything like that, and I just had to understand.
Did you ever try to interview him?
Yes.
Or ever try to make contact?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. And through Human Courier, we would pass notes.
Oh, really?
And in fact, there was a point where in my request for an interview, because I would send him questions in Arabic on Time Magazine letterhead. And sometimes I'd get a response and sometimes I didn't. As best as we can tell, pieced together from information we've since gleaned, at one point Zarqawi apparently decided, yes, I will allow Michael Ware to interview me. He didn't tell me that. He contracted a group of criminal kidnappers to grab me, to sit on me for a week to make sure I didn't have a bug inserted inside me, and then I was going to apparently get the interview. Unfortunately, for that 1 week of the war, there was 2 6-foot-tall Australians coming and going from my house. I was letting a friend of mine from Australia stay at our house. They kidnapped the wrong Australian.
Oh, my God. You're kidding me. Boy, I pity that guy. Did he actually make it back alive?
We did. I negotiated his release. Jeez. Because he hadn't yet been passed on to the Islamic State. Wow. When the kidnappers realized their error, oh, my God, we've just screwed the pooch on an Islamic State contract, they panicked and gave him back. But, yes, so there was some communications.
Okay. Yeah, and at one point earlier on, the insurgency in Al-Qaeda, whatever you want to call it,
the
Islamic State, for all intents and purposes, takes over Haifa Street in Baghdad, which I really didn't realize when I was watching this on the news that the media made it sound like we had locked down Baghdad.
Oh, that was nonsense. That was nonsense. Yeah. The only part of Baghdad, you know, we or our troops ever controlled, really, was that piece of Baghdad immediately under our boots.
Yeah.
We never controlled Baghdad. Are you joking?
Yeah.
But yes, in the center of Baghdad, at the very heart of the city, was an area called Haifa Street. Now, that was controlled by the nationalist political insurgents. Mm-hmm. But one day, in a particularly furious battle with the American forces who were responsible for that area, I mean, our forces did not own Haifa Street. They visited it.
Mm-hmm.
And every time they did, they had a 72% expectation of contact with the enemy. Now, during one particularly furious engagement with our forces that was so bloody and so bad that when we withdrew, we had to abandon a Bradley fighting vehicle behind.
Wow.
Now, Zarqawi's Islamic State people jump on top of the hulking wreck and start waving their flags. That wasn't just a blow against us. That was a blow against the insurgency. Because, you know, these relatively moderate, politically motivated former West Pointers of Iraq had controlled the area. Mm. But that day, the psychopaths of the Holy War captured the heart of Baghdad, not just from us, but from the Iraqi insurgents. This is an area that was in mortar range of the U.S. Embassy and the Iraqi government's seat of power in the Green Zone. It was a monumental shift in the tide of the war.
Yeah, and as I was referencing earlier, at one point you're going to meet with the insurgents, for lack of a better word, we'll call them the good insurgents.
Yeah.
You know? And then you get kidnapped by Zarqawi's guys.
I knew these men in this area.
You almost died.
I knew these men in this area, right? I visited them many, 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 many times. Because, you know, they may have been on the other side of this conflict to our boys, but you could relate to their motivations. We might disagree, but at least you could understand where they're coming from. The religious holy warriors, I mean, they're from another planet.
Yeah.
So when this battle takes place and the holy warriors take over, the local insurgent commander, who'd been a colonel or one-star general in the Iraqi army, sent a messenger to me, one of his mid-ranking commanders, to alert me to this. It wasn't that the Americans had been defeated. It was the holy war has taken over part of the capital.
Mm-hmm.
He was as disturbed by this as any American commander.
Hmm.
And when he sent this mid-ranking commander to tell me, I said, I believe you, but for me to be able to tell the American public and the Western public, I need to see it with my own eyes. He goes, well, that's precisely why I'm here. I've been brought here to bring you in, to take you back in, to let you see this new Islamic State occupied territory.
Hmm.
And that's when we were spotted. And that's when I was dragged by the car, from our car, by these Islamic State warriors. And I was dragged behind a building. and with a banner hastily slung on the side of the building, I was being prepared for my own beheading that they were going to film with my own camera.
Oh, wow. And so then what happened? How did
I was saved by the insurgents.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's amazing. That's like something out of a movie where you get to that moment and really someone, bad you get a phone call.
Yeah, yeah. It almost came down to that. Jeez. But I was saved by, you know, the insurgents.
Wow.
Who said, he is our guest. You dishonor us if you kill our guest.
Yeah.
And that right now you outnumber us and you can behead this guy. But just know that if you do so, we're going to start a turf war.
Yeah.
And on that day, at that time, the Syrians and the foreigners of the Islamic State knew they simply couldn't afford that turf war. And without a hint of exaggeration, it was through gritted teeth that these Syrian holy warriors shoved me back to the Iraqis and said, fine, take him, get him out of here.
Wow.
And for the next 3 days, I didn't leave my bedroom.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. I would leave the country. You know, we haven't talked about this too much, but you were also embedded with our troops, with the Marines in Fallujah and Ramadi. Did they ever confront you about your professional relationship with the insurgents or that they gave you videos to
One of my greatest responsibilities in Iraq. You know, yes, I'm living among the Iraqis. And yes, I see the insurgency and this and that. And there's 25 million Iraqis, men, women, and children. And my responsibility is to convey to you and to the rest of the world what these civilians are going through. But my greatest privilege during the war was to convey the experience of your Marines and soldiers. And it is my tremendous honor to say that I'm one of the first civilians in the history of the United States to nominate a soldier for the Medal of Honor. I was embraced by the U.S. military, from the upper echelons in the command down to the kids who are kicking in the doors, who are sitting in the gun turrets, who are on patrol, because I bled and I sweat with them. And my most sacred duty was conveying their story, not what the generals are saying, not what the war planners are saying, but to tell you here back at home what your children were going through. And I can tell you now that every one of them, every unit I went to, every platoon, every section that I was with knew that I was also going out with the other side, and they got it.
Yeah, and in the end, you quote one of those soldiers as saying, certain dark chambers of the heart, once opened, can never be closed again. And there's a scene at the very end of the film that really is gut-wrenching, and you say that that was where you found your dark place.
Yeah.
Before we go, what did that do to you?
Well, I think it's what it had already done to me by that point.
Yeah.
And maybe it was a realization. When we ask our children to go to war, and it can be for the right reasons, it can be for the wrong reasons, once we're on the ground, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who sent them or why they sent them. A soldier or a Marine's war is that 200 yards right in front of them.
Yeah.
And they're not fighting for the president. They're not fighting for noble ideas or foreign policy or democracy. You know what they're fighting for? The brother standing next to them.
Yeah.
And they will give their life to make sure that that brother gets home. And that man will give his life to make sure they get home. Yeah. And it's a love story, really, about what these kids are doing, you know?
Yeah.
And what you need to understand, you can never fully comprehend, but hopefully you can, through this film, you can gain one small new insight. When we send these kids to these places, we ask them to go to a place in their hearts and their minds that is so dark and so nasty and so base that they lose themselves. It's kill or be killed.
Yeah.
And that's what we ask of them. And that's what they have to come home with. And I love each and every one of them for that.
Yeah. Well, I know that you have to go. So before we go, real quick, can I just ask one more question? If Al Zarqawi died before you ever got a chance to interview him, is there one question that you would have liked to have asked him that you wanted to know?
I don't know. I mean, part of it would have been why, you know, and his answer would have been, you know, to create the caliphate. Yeah. But the one answer I really wanted to know that he would never have been able to answer is how. How can a human, I mean, I've just spoken about that hard place a soldier or marine must go to.
Yeah.
Zarqawi takes humanity somewhere far past that. I mean, it is a darker echelon of being.
That's a scary corner of the human soul.
That I still don't understand. As far as I have been, and I have been down the darkest rabbit hole, I still don't understand. And how he, not just himself, but took a whole new generation of Muslims to that same place, the place that we're still dealing with now, still eludes me. I mean, you want to talk about the heart of darkness. We're still only beginning to understand it.
Well, Michael Ware, the film is called Only the Dead See the End of the War, and it airs tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Mate, thank you so much.
Thanks again to Michael Ware for coming on the podcast. We just really touched on the tip of the iceberg in this interview, but there are some scenes in this film that are beyond belief. And I'll warn you, it's not for the faint of heart, but it is an excellent film, and it really gets into what it was like for the soldiers on the ground and the darkness of war, as well as a fascinating window into the gruesome birth of the Islamic State. Again, it's called Only the Dead See the End of the War, and it airs tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern on HBO, or you can download it with a subscription to HBO Go or HBO Now. Now, don't forget to subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics and leave us a review on iTunes. That helps a bunch with our podcast ratings. And if you really want to help us out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. Or you can click the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. It'll help us reach our fundraising goal for this year, and your support will be very much appreciated. Follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook. And while you're there, recommend Kickass Politics to your friends on your social media. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.